Welcome to Castorbis. I'm Christian Corley, and you're about to hear the interview between my good colleague James McLean and Tom Selinski, the author of Red Dwarf, Discovering the TV Series, Volume 1, 1988 to 1993, the first of a two-part collection. This is a shorter version than the one that we released on Patreon. So if you would like to listen to the full 40-minute chat, head over to patreon.com/Castorbis and join free. That's right, our Patreon is free. So that's something to think about as you are listening to James McLean and Tom Selinski concerning Red Dwarf.
Welcome, Tom, to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tom, this is Red Dwarf, Discovering the TV Series. We are going to be talking about Volume 1. And the first question I would like to verify with you is obviously this is Volume 1. Volume 2?
Volume 2 is written, yes. So what happened was I pitched this book and the publisher said, yes, please, and I started writing it. And then what I delivered them was a 180,000-word manuscript. And they said, could you cut this by a third? And I said no. And then for about 4 months, we stood at an impasse until eventually they said, well, how about we publish it in two volumes instead then? So what you have now are... It fell into two halves very, very neatly. You've got that first run of six BBC series, and then you've got the more vertiginous ups and downs in terms of quality and fan enjoyment of the last two BBC series and then the Dave shows. All to come in Volume 2, along with various apocrypha, the American pilot... the novels, episodes that were written and never made, and so on and so on.
It's incredible for me because, I mean, I've talked a lot to a lot of people around a lot of sci-fi shows, and I've never touched on Red Dwarf. And yet, reading the book, it's fascinating to see someone who kind of grew up with it in the same sort of way, in the same sort of era. I think my first encounter with... I didn't get it on the first series. I think it was... I think Me Squared was the... first one.
It's the end of series one.
Series one, yeah. And then I think, as you say in the book, there's actually a very short period before series two started. So I think then I flowed into series two and then played catch up with series one later.
Series one wasn't repeated for a long time. Rob and Doug, the writers, felt that they had learnt much more about how the show was working. And especially from series three onwards, they were busily retconning all sorts of awkward things they'd committed to in series one, confident that no one would ever see series one. So they actually blocked a repeat showing of series one, which they were offered. And it was a long time before series one was available on VHS, if you remember those.
Yes, yes. I had them on VHS as well.
I hope she's not disrupting the recording, but my own cat, Toast, has decided that she wants to be on my lap during this. So if you can hear purring, that is my cat, Toast, and not a problem with your equipment.
Absolutely fine. It's a little bit of ASMR plug-in.
You
can enjoy that in the background. Yeah, I mean, the season one is fascinating, and you do, again, touch on this in the book. For those who haven't read the book, which none of you will have yet, you start off with a bit of a historical chronology of the before the series starts, and then you sort of intertwine that when you're actually talking about the series as production goes on. So you talk about this, but I think what's really fascinating is a bit like with Blackadder, that the first series is kind of like the child that the creators don't really want to be associated with. That's really curious.
Yes, I think Red Dwarf is more of an evolution than Blackadder, where they completely reinvented how the show was going to work at the end of the first series. I remember, again, from my childhood, to launch the second series of Blackadder, Rowan Atkinson going on the Wogan show and explaining why they'd made these changes, saying that one of their aims for this first series had been to do lots of location filming, lots of shooting on film to try and give it a real sense of history and atmosphere. And the BBC had come back and said they were interested in the second series, but only if it was cheaper and funnier. So Rowan Atkinson said, we've really aimed with this one to give them a much better joke per pound ratio.
And oddly, kind of similar to their pilot as well. But that's another show, I guess.
Yes.
But yeah, so I really enjoyed Red Dwarf. And again, it's one of those things, it's like if I'd watched it from the first episode onwards, maybe I'd have had a different sense of coming in essentially on series two and then probably catching up with series one. As you said, it was a few years before we actually got to see it again. But because one of the, and again, I'm not casting any shade here. The one of the episodes I really like in series one is the one that you absolutely hate, Well, you don't abdicate. Waiting for God is one I think I can understand reading your critique, and your critique is very interesting on this, why you don't like it. And it's very interesting that I kind of feel reading that as like I'm kind of the other way. But throughout the book, and I think what I like here is that you do very nicely synthesize the issues of structure and frameworks of this episode around comedy. Because sometimes I think when we think of comedy, we think of the one-off jokes or the moments which get us, rather than that the whole, that sort of, with the sitcom especially, that through line that you've got to have, where there's got to be a structure and there's got to be a plot that intertwines that comedy.
Yeah, it's funny, the typical structure of a sitcom episode, whether it's American or British, is an A plot and a B plot, and they run along side by side, and then if you're really lucky, then they collide at exactly the right moment at the end. But you know what? I think the first episode of Red Dwarf that really does that properly, there's a couple of early ones that do have an A and a B plot, but they tend not to collide. But the first one that does that really properly is Trojan, which is the first episode of Series 10. One of the Dave series. The writers instead hit upon a slightly different structure, which I describe in the book as the A plot creates the B plot. So rather than the A and B plots running side by side, you have a body swap is a good example. There's 10 minutes at the beginning, which is all about the Scutters having gone nuts and rewired the ship and them setting off the self-destruct accidentally, or so they think. And that's resolved. But what's left is this discovery, oh, we can actually put someone else's mind into Lister's body. And so then that leads to body swap. So the A plot is created by the B plot. But they don't go back and forth. So that doesn't give you that powerful catharsis you can get when two seemingly unrelated plot strands collide. But what it does do is it means that you can let each part grow or shrink according to how inspired you are. And one of the reasons I think Body Swap is a particularly good episode is because that first segment, which you could argue is sort of irrelevant because most of what happens in it is never referred to again, but as a little self-contained section, it works really well. It's really funny, it's really exciting, and it's hard to see the punchline coming.
And it's really interesting because, as you said, like with Trojan, but also if you look at American animated comedy, that's become a framework which you'll see a lot in things like Futurama and The Simpsons, where they will do a very long, as you say, this sort of A plot, which leads into a totally different tangential B one. But they weren't doing that. No one was doing that in the 90s.
No.
It was just not done. And yet, as you say, Body Swap, which again, I think is, I remember at the time, that was a big laugh when you get the toffee crisp bar pop
yes.
out. Brilliantly played. And again, I think part of the success of that is as it just wasn't done. And to see that done in that way was, you know, really quite unusual.
Excuse me, could I just distract you for a brief second?
You've done for each, as I say, you do your bit at the beginning, which is kind of the history, the behind the scenes of the creation of the show, which again is a fascinating creation, akin to many BBC dramas. Doctor Who probably has a similar sort of uncomfortable awakening and finding itself. But Red Dwarf certainly is, as a sitcom, as you point out, an unusual thing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Doctor Who had the benefit of being the brainchild of the man who had the ability to say yes and no to other people's ideas, Sidney Newman. Whereas the problem with Red Dwarf is that Rob and Doug were freelance writers trying to sell it in, and nobody at the BBC seemed to think that anyone was interested in watching science fiction. So yes, there's a big long thing in the book about how they made various representations to the head of Light Entertainment, all of which fell on deaf ears. And their tiny, petty revenge was eventually to use this man's surname as one of the creative insults or sort of semi-square words that they came up with.
Yeah, again, in the book, which is a great bit. And Jackson's role in this was, you know, critically important too.
Yeah, he was this towering figure in BBC comedy. He was one of the people who... He'd been working on much sort of tamer shows, things like The Two Ronnies or Jasper Carrot, in a junior capacity and beginning to build up his credentials as a producer. But he figured out he could sort of span the divide between the anarchic goings-on at the Raymond Review Bar with people like Alexei Sale and Rick Mayall virtually hanging from the chandeliers like anything to get a laugh. But he also knew how television worked. Mm. And so he was really instrumental in bridging that divide and doing a show like The Young Ones, which was so physically ambitious. You know, you watch the first episode of The Young Ones and Adrian Emerson makes his entrance bursting through the wall of a set, which was achieved by having a plaster wall rigged with explosives and sliding Adrian Emerson down a chute and trying to time it so that by the time he reached the wall was no longer there. And you get one shot at doing that in front of a live studio audience. So this is pretty ambitious stuff. Paul Jackson co-directing with Jeff Posner there. And so he knew this world, and I think he'd proven himself to the BBC as a pretty safe pair of hands. And Red Dwarf also kind of has one foot in that alternative comedy, anarchic punk, spitting image, young ones world, but also a foot in the much more traditional BBC sitcom. Their comedy writing idols were Ray Galton and Alan Simpson, who'd written Steptoe and Son. And there's a very clear echo of Steptoe and Son, especially the early episodes, because it's that well-worn sitcom trope, two men who hate each other, who are trapped together.
Yeah, yeah. I'm one of the funny things with Red Dwarf, I think, because like when you talk about the young ones and what Jackson and Paul Jackson and the team were doing there, was that almost like you get with different eras of comedy, this sort of fight against the previous period of where comedy was a little more traditional, a little more conservative. And then you get this 80s period where you get this chaos, the sort of breakdown of those sort of established conventions of comedy. And we've had changes since. And suddenly people like Ricky Gervais and John Cleese suddenly seem a little out of touch compared to where comedy is now. Yet Red Dwarf still holds up pretty well.
Yes, I think so. The fact they were able to come back so successfully on Dave after, as I said, a sort of experimental middle period where various things are tried, not all of which work, and eventually, like a planet orbiting a star, they eventually come back to these four guys on a spaceship 3 million years into deep space, which is the show we all fell in love with to begin with. But yeah, maybe it's because it has those traditional sitcom bones. But at the time, it felt very fresh. And certainly one of the things that attracted me to it when I first saw it in the Radio Times in February of 1988 was I knew a lot of those faces. I knew Chris Barry, I knew Craig Charles, I knew Norman Lovett. I'd seen them all on Saturday Live, if nowhere else. And I knew Chris Barry as a voice on Spitting Image. Because even at 15, I think I would have been, I was getting interested in tracking the careers of people whose output I enjoyed. So, I think it had that freshness which helped make it stand apart from reruns of Dad's Army. But at the same time, it's actually very traditional in its core. Toast agrees with me.
Toast does seem to agree with you on that. Yeah, I think it has. And I think also the comedy in it has a very nice blend of never being too edgy to a point that it falls out of vogue, but so it's still, the jokes still carry land and nothing feels particularly offensive. It holds its own really well, especially those first few seasons.
Nothing looks so old-fashioned as somebody who was trying to be shocking yesterday.
Yeah, exactly, absolutely. So I mean, I noticed there was a line that you have in your acknowledgements where you put Rob and Doug, please don't be cross with me.
Yes.
Do you genuinely have that sort of feeling when you're doing something which is a bit of an analysis where you are breaking down someone's artwork?
Yeah, I mean, there's various views about this. I'm quite the pragmatist, you know, as someone who has written material both for stage and for audio dramas. I've long ago made my peace with the fact that once you put something out into the world, other people get to have their say about it. And I reject the idea that you have to be a wonderful practitioner yourself to earn the right to criticise what someone else is doing. The point of this kind of art, if we can call it that, is to put it in front of people and see what they think. So if it isn't pleasing people, then they have a right to say so. At the same time, I'm acutely aware how hard this stuff is. And I know that all of these episodes, from the ones I think are wonderful works of towering genius to the ones I think are rather more misbegotten, were all made with passion and dedication. And you know, the ones that I enjoy less took as much hard work as the ones I enjoy enormously and will watch over and over again. But also, a very specific thing happened to me about 10 years ago, which is that I had a very similar book all ready to go with an American publisher on the subject of Columbo and I was going to treat it in a very similar way, a mix of behind-the-scenes stuff and critical analysis and so on. And they said, we think this is terrific, we think there's an audience for it, we just want you to check with NBC Universal that they don't have any objections to it. I wrote various letters to NBC Universal, which got no reply. And eventually, I think the publisher was at the point of saying, well, let's just go for it then, when NBC Universal responded, basically saying, if you print a book with the word Columbo in it anywhere, we will sue you into oblivion. And so there the project languished. So I was a bit reluctant to approach Rob and Doug for interviews or even other people associated with the production. I did do a couple of original interviews for this, but not very many, just because I didn't want the project to get killed, because I thought there would be an audience for it and I was enjoying writing it. So yes, Rob and Doug, if you're listening, please don't be cross with me. It's all met with love. And as one writer to another, please don't kill my book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you put in the book, you say, you know, I've come to praise Red Dwarf, not bury it.
Yeah, of course.
And I think that's... and it's very clear throughout the book, which has quite a long title, The Complete and Unauthorised Guide to the Classic Comedy Show on Screen and Behind the Scenes.
I think that was imposed on me by the publisher.
I like it. I like a long title. Waiting for God is a really interesting episode for me. And as I said, when I was reading through your individual critical analysis, and you do it with... lots of little breakdowns, which are obviously a lot of fun. The continuity for Snakeheads, and there's a time and a place. The time and a place I thought was fascinating, because that really is something which speaks from a position of now. I thought that was interesting because I really, really liked that episode. And yet at the same time, reading it, I could kind of see where you had some issues with it. Certainly... It's probably more ambitious than it can allow to be. You know, introduces a race that it then just swipes away.
And it's interesting that the most recent episode, The Promised Land, is going back to that wellspring of inspiration. So clearly there was something there. But I think, there's a few things I don't like about it. I don't like the fact that Rimmer's off in his own very uninteresting side plot. Mm. One of the things I don't like about some of those early episodes is what I call Doofus Rimmer. Because I think it's too easy to write Rimmer as a doofus, and I don't think that's what he is. I think he's self-obsessed and error-prone and doesn't appreciate others, you know, doesn't play well with others. But I don't think he's a doofus, and he's a complete doofus in this episode. But that might be worth it if there was a wonderful payoff for that, which there isn't. He's just in his own subplot. And then when we finally get to what should be a really powerful moment of the cat and the cat priest being reunited and Lister realising the impact he's had on the society, everyone just sort of shrugs and goes, oh, well, that's the thing that happened then. It doesn't have any guts.
Don't destroy it, Tom. You're destroying it for me. This is... I must admit, I really liked it. I think it comes down to, as you say, do you buy in to the doofusness or not? Can you let that go? Because it's very much an 80s trope of these sort of very British, pompous... arrogant people who are so more pompous and arrogant than they are smart. So they're so intrigued in their own little world that they just don't see beyond what the audience can see, and that's where the joke comes from. And I suppose if that doesn't sit with you, then the whole thing just absolutely falls apart.
And listen, you know, both Rob and Doug were play fast and loose with continuity all the time. Mm. So in the space of a single series, series two, you have one version of Rimmer who is exercise mad, who is up at the crack of dawn, who is on the exercise bike, who is encouraging Lister to do more. And then in Queeg, he is moaning that he isn't being allowed to lie in. He's being made to run something he clearly hates doing. I would, on the whole, much rather that comedy writers in particular focus on what's going to make this episode entertaining and funny and not get too bogged down in that kind of detail. But that doesn't stop me having a little bit of fun on my own, pointing out all the inconsistencies.
Absolutely, and that's one of the great bits of the book. I think with Waiting for God, what I remember as a kid, what I really liked was... I mean, Red Dwarf, like Doctor Who, has that innate Britishness, and culturally so. You know, we actually have characters from the North in there and the South, and it's kind of unusual. And I think having just that line that Holly has, that, you know, well, it's a laugh, isn't it? You know, that, the whole setup, that you realise this whole episode largely is going to be just about very bored people having fun at someone's expense. And that, in a weird way, for science fiction... felt really fresh. I mean, yes, you can see it in other shows and you'd probably see something a bit like that might happen in Cheers at the time, or Blackadder certainly. But in science fiction, that felt, I don't know, it did feel like it was touching on that sort of 2001 Dark Star roots that you talk yes. about as well.
Yeah, Dark Star, very obviously. Yeah, I just think there are way better examples of that elsewhere in the Red Dwarf canon.
Absolutely. I mean, one that I think everyone agrees, and you agree in the book as well, you know, Queeg, as you said, yes. is an incredible payoff. And I always wondered, I mean, obviously they're that live audience there, but, you know, if that live audience that we hear is actually of that moment, the moment where, you know, he does the, we're talking Jape of the Month, April, May, yes. July, and you can hear the audience slowly catching on to where the joke
yes.
is.
Yeah. That's a nice bit of writing. That's only just struck me, actually. But yeah, Norman Lovett has about four lines which all essentially mean the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's really smart because it means that the audience has time to process this yeah. enormous rug pull that's just been unleashed upon them.
And that's always, I think that's always a beautiful part of writing where you can allow the audience to get the joke just a fraction before it comes up. But you know you've already got them. That if the joke is a twist... That's a lovely moment. If you can pull in your twist at a point where you're allowing the audience to realise just before the joke, so they think they've got it, but it's too late. So they can enjoy that yes. moment, but they've not actually won that moment.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of comedy is a combination of anticipation and surprise. And in fact, you can't have surprise without anticipation, because surprise is about the audience anticipating one thing and then being surprised. But sometimes just the anticipation is also delicious.
One thing I did also... jumping from Queeg that I noticed and I liked, because I think this is always a shame, was Hattie as Holly is often overlooked, certainly arguably in the show. And you while you don't obviously make a big thing about that, I liked how you sort of acknowledge what I think was an underappreciated part.
Yes, I think they realised eventually that five characters was too many, so they wrote her out of series six. But I think she's really strong. I actually laughed out loud rewatching Backwards, not one of my favourite episodes. But she has that moment right at the beginning where Rimmer asks her what time period she thinks they're in, and she yes. says, lunchtime, about half one.
Yeah.
And her little hopeful micro expression as she says it, I just think is delightful. And it's a great example of the same but different. You know, she's clearly cut from the same cloth as the Norman Lovett Holly, but there are lines that she has which you can't imagine Norman yeah. Lovett delivering.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And especially even more so, obviously, probably her biggest episode, White Hole, which is very yes. much feels like it's built around Hattie rather than Norman. You couldn't do that with Norman.
No. Or at least it would be a very, very different episode.
Yes, it would be a very different episode. But yes, it's the stuff she does with Talkie Toaster.
yes.
Is brilliant. So, but yeah, this is a great book. I mean, there's loads of things. I mean, I follow the show. A lot of the extra material I followed and read or watched as well. But I mean, I was still learning stuff in there, which appealed, you know, was really nice to see and understand. I must admit, I missed the Starbug being white initially, and then, as you say, it being shifted to green to so it wouldn't sort of fall disappear within the snow for marooned.
Oh yes, yeah. It was originally referred to as White Midget.
So, I mean, I'm going to ask you kind of a couple of obvious questions, and one of these, yeah. if you read the book, you'll see in detail. But do you want to sort of drop, say, a couple of your absolute favourites?
Our favourite episodes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it might be different to the book. You might have changed your mind since then.
No, I don't think so. The one that kind of I was slightly unprepared for how much I would enjoy watching it again was Quarantine. Mm-hmm. When I put it on, I thought, well, this is clearly going to be four, maybe even 4.5 stars. But every bit of it is just so brilliantly worked out. Mm. And the stakes ramp up and up and up, and it's incredibly funny. And it is one of those iconic ones. You know, people go to conventions dressed as Chris Barry and all that red gingham with those Pippi Longstocking bunches. and Mr. Flibble took on a complete life of his own. That was just a puppet that somebody grabbed out of stock. And when we think about, like, what can we do with our setup, which is, as I said, basically two men who hate each other, but this is really that to the max. Mm. In some ways, even more than Marooned. And Marooned has a couple of little quibbly things I don't like about it, although it's a very, very strong episode as well. But Quarantine really is fantastic. It's definitely in my top five. I think it's one of three I gave the full five stars to.
Do you want to name one more?
And then Dimension Jump's probably my absolute favourite. There's so much to enjoy about Dimension Jump. I think this is in the book. The story is that Chris Barry, who was shooting Red Dwarf for 3 or 4 months of the year and the British Empire for 3 or 4 months of the year, felt he was suffering from what he called git overload and said to Robin Dugg, is there any way you could write something for me which doesn't require me to be quite so much of a git? What I love about Ace Rimmer is, in his own way, he's just as punchable.
Yes.
He's an improvement, arguably. Yes. He's certainly more competent than our Rimmer, but he's not really, everyone's going, what a guy, but I don't know how much time I'd actually want to spend in his company.
No.
And it's a great performance from Chris Barry, completely reinventing the character. And that twist at the end, that it's our Rimmer, the Rimmer we're familiar with, who got what to him would be the lucky break, he didn't have to repeat a year of school. Mm. That's really, really good. And that's what I think tips it over from a really strong, funny, imaginative episode to one that's actually got something to say about how people tell the stories of their own lives. It's really good.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, he's a play on so many sci-fi archetypes, you know, the Dan Dares and the likes. And
yeah, it's a bit of Dan Dare, a bit of Han Solo, a bit of James Bond, a bit of Top Gun, you know, there's everything going on in there.
Oh yeah, the obvious Top Gun connotations in there, aren't there, as well. But yeah, and it's great for the rest of the cast as well. The rest of the cast have a bit of fun.
And weirdly, it's only Robert Llewellyn in the titles who's given two credits. Everyone else is just Craig Charles Lister, as you'd expect. But for Robert Llewellyn, it's, what's his name, Bongo. Mm. He's credited as Crichton / Bongo, presumably because somebody was worried that people wouldn't recognise Robert Llewellyn without all that rubber on him.
Yeah, a KG agent.
Yes.
No, it's a good one, that. It's one that I think when I watched that as a young lad, it was a season where I was starting to feel that my expectations of the effects were sort of getting in the way of some of my enjoyment of the show. So even though there was some beautiful little model work that's done especially in that story, it was kind of taking away from it. But at the same time, yeah, as you say, the fact that I never thought about that Rimmer is just as terrible as a hero as he is as an idiot. And everyone seems to almost be spellbound. But yeah, you do kind of wonder if those people who left him behind in his previous dimension were kind of happy after things just became normal and they could live like people. But yeah, it's brilliant. Even down to him doing his own stitches, small things like that were great.
It reminds me of, do you remember the Danny Kaye film, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty?
I remember, I remember it being a thing.
One of his fantasies is that he's an RAF pilot, and when he comes back from his mission, his commanding officer says, you're right there, Mitty. And he says, oh, nothing, sir, just a scratch. Said the bone myself.
That sort of approach. There's just so much, even down to the small things which aren't horrendously funny, like the fact that Rimmer still is trying to outdo him at the very end by smoking him.
Dumping fish on him.
Fish. It's a childish thing, but it just kind of is poignant because, you know, it's just showing again that this person has just got nothing out of this. And then to have the Hammond organ recital night, I think is at the end of that episode, just shows again that he's learned nothing from seeing a better version of himself.
And this is the art of good sitcom writing. It's creating that dynamic tension between the characters. So we get the feeling that we go through something with them, but they fundamentally will not change. Their relationships might deepen and enrichen a little, but they'll always be that same tension between them, and that's why we keep watching.
Is there an era then that you feel you'd be particularly drawn to, if you were to say, is the era for you personally, is where it was at its height?
Yeah, it's probably series 4 and 5. I think that's where everything is really working. 5, I think, is the season which ends with Back to Reality, and that's the other 5-star one for me. That's fantastic. There's good stuff all the way through. Like I said, series 7 and 8 are a bit more experimental. Some of the reasons for those experiments were forced upon the creative team, and some are of their own making. But I think it is interesting that they revert back to type not long after that.
Was that?
So I don't think those are quite so successful.
I'm going to say thank you for this. When are we anticipating it's out?
I think it will be kind of the same time next year, so early autumn next year, I believe.
So early autumn. So,
Star Trek books coming out in the
interim. What's about Volume 1?
Volume 1's out now.
Volume 1 is out now, sorry.
It's out now, yes, wherever books are sold. And Volume 2, I think, will be out same time as like September next year.
Well, that's brilliant, and I'll be interested to see your other ones. Thank you.
Lovely stuff, James. Thank you so much for having me.
So we're around 30 minutes of the chat there. There's another 10 minutes that you can listen to if you sign up to our free Patreon. Now, I'll tell you something else. We also have a giveaway. One copy of Tom's book is available to win, again, if you are a free Patreon member. So head over to patreon.com/castorbis, become a patron for free. I'm not sure what sort of patronage is usually available for free. This one is, and you get all of our stuff early and complete. You have the option, if you wish to, of paying to join our Patreon. There are a couple of bonuses that we can give you if you choose that option. But as I say, the podcast is available early. It's available in extended form, and it's also ad-free if you join our Patreon. Now I'll be back with our usual weekly show in a few days' time. Until then, it's goodbye from me.